switch to French, as anticipated by Olivier. On est très content d'accueillir aujourd'hui donc Juan Carlos de Martin, qui est ici grâce au programme de directeur d'études associé. Il restera avec nous pendant un mois. Il sera aussi invité dans le séminaire du Collège d'études mondiales, le séminaire de recherche qu'on tient à peu près deux fois par mois ici à la Fondation. Donc Juan Carlos de Martin est professeur au Polytechnique de Turin. Donc c'est passé. Ok, il est professeur au Polytechnique de Turin. Il est en particulier spécialiste des questions de droit en Internet, des questions politiques et éthiques. Il a une activité très vivante aussi dans les quotidiens italiens, pour le Sole 24 Ore notamment. Et il est aussi fellow à Harvard. Et donc voilà, je te cède la parole. Donc ça sera aussi question de pouvoir. Hein. C'est le projet aussi de directeur d'études associé qui est centré vraiment sur la question du pouvoir et Internet. Et aujourd'hui, donc il nous présentera en particulier un talk basé sur smartphone and power. Et je te cède la parole.
Thank you for the introduction and thank you for the invitation being here. I'm sorry that I cannot speak French with the same fluency that I hope I have at least occasionally in English. So thank you. Regarding language, I just make a very quick comment regarding the introduction by the director. Regarding language, absolutely, it's very important to think about language because the way we can express ourselves in our mother tongue, the detail, the precision is, of course, unparalleled in whichever other language we end up learning. And that's why, incidentally, I think it's important to keep a national scientific community, which at this time in Italy, and I don't want to get into Italian politics, academic politics, but right now in Italy, for decisions from the ministry, we are in danger of losing a national scientific community because there is such an enormous push to publish only in English, which is normal for me. I'm an engineer, but in the humanities, it's really new to some extent. Almost losing the possibility of having a national conversation in our own language. And what we see continuously is that even when we try to speak in Italian, there are so many English words used only because they are English, not because they bring any specific contribution to the discussion that is sometimes embarrassing, I have to say. So thank you for mentioning that. My favorite answer would be to switch to Latin, which is we've used for a long time, and it's not as very little geopolitical indication because people, I don't think they're afraid anymore of the Roman Empire, so I think that Latin would be a good choice, but I guess it's a bit difficult to implement. So I'm here to talk about smartphones and power. And in doing that, I think it's important to start quickly, because I want to stay in the 30 minutes limit, quickly to think about how was the configuration of power with simpler technology, which was the plain old telephones, and interestingly, the engineers actually called them plain old telephone, POT, which is funny. Exactly one service, real-time interactive voice. People tend to forget that, but it was pretty easy to be anonymous. So it's a technology that allowed pretty good anonymity. If you didn't introduce yourself and you just masked your voice, it was easy to be somewhat anonymous at least. Because telephones, as we know, corresponded to specific physical locations. So a number corresponding to a specific geographical precise location. Now, let's look at the distribution of power in plain old telephones. So users have the power, which can be used for good and for bad, or making anonymous calls, particularly if using cash and payphones, but more generally speaking, it was true as well. Now, what the other, essentially, there were, besides the user, only two other actors, the telephone companies and governments. The telephone companies automatically know, for billing purposes, which telephone called which other telephone, at what time and for how long. That's by default because of billing purposes. To determine who called, so to be sure about who made a specific call, it required targeted old-fashioned surveillance. So you had to deploy some people on the ground in order to find out who made the specific call. And also to determine what was said required targeted old-fashioned surveillance, which is called wiretapping, okay? Phone manufacturers essentially no power, and I underline that because then when we'll come back to smartphones, that's big change. So essentially they were making dumb equipment, okay? They're just following some standards and they had essentially no choice other than maybe a little bit of design. Now switch to cellular phones. About 25 years ago, we started using this technology, which incidentally, the roots of this technology go back to the early 20th century, but it was widely deployed only in the 80s and 90s. Now, for a long time, only two services, real-time voice, and just a small afterthought, which proved to be incredibly popular, which is the short text messages. The telephone is not tied anymore to a location, but to a person. Now, the crucial passage is, the crucial step is that now telephone locations, which means users' location, are tracked in real time. So now, this is by technological needs. It's cellular, so you need to attach a specific mobile phone to a cell base station, so we have to know the location. So this is unavoidable given the technology. With this technology, it's hard to be anonymous because the telephone is attached to a specific person. In many countries, you have to show a strong proof of identity to get a phone. So the telephone, unless you give your own phone to somebody else, but you will end up in trouble anyway, it's hard to be anonymous. Now, power. Users cannot easily make anonymous calls because the phone is personal. The telephone companies still know what they used to know. Okay, so we'll just skip it. So they still know who's calling what, for how long, etc. But they also know automatically where the phone is at all times, if the phone is switched on, okay? Again, it's unavoidable, they have to. Which means that as somebody, I think it was from law enforcement, said users essentially in the last 25 years have voluntarily and gladly accepted to pay to wear a location tracker at all times. This location information is available, of course, to phone companies, and to my knowledge, is extremely easy to access to law enforcement, even without a court order. So they have access to the databases, so it's very easy to know, even to make searches like who is in a certain area and to come up with all the phone numbers of a certain area. To determine who called is automatic, in the sense that the phone is personal, so we know who's calling. And determined what was said still requires targeted old-fashioned surveillance. Phone manufacturers, so good old Nokia and all the others, Ericsson, no power in the sense that they were following precise standards, GSM standards in Europe, NTIA standards in the US, etc. They were competing on design, but essentially they didn't have really a strong power on what was going on the networks. Now, finally, smartphones. Now, the point that we'll try to make in the next 20 minutes is that it's a profound discontinuity that changes radically what's going on in the telephone networks. Because there are no more dedicated devices. So that's the main point. Cellular phones, they were more sophisticated, but still they were dedicated devices making only a few very simple things. Now there is a switch, no more dedicated device, but full-fledged, wearable, general-purpose, internet-enabled computers, which also happen to have phone capabilities. Now this is a big change in the sense that everything becomes much more complicated, and I will try to explain why. We're dealing now with general purpose computers because they are really general purpose computers connected to the internet. Now these two points, let's try to get a bit deeper into that. Computers, simplifying them, we have the hardware structure, and so this, like for instance, then we have the operating system that allows to the control of all the hardware and allows applications to run on top of the hardware. Okay, so just like make an example, hardware could be a laptop or our smartphone. Operating system can be Windows, macOS, or in the case of smartphone, we will see iOS and Android, and applications, whatever applications we want to run. Now, in with general purpose computers, which started in the 70s, in their personal form, we tend to be quite capable of installing also other operating systems. It's pretty easy on a laptop, it's trickier with a smartphone, and we can run any application. Definitely true on a laptop, trickier on a smartphone. So this is the first point, we're dealing with computers. And so each of these three levels means that other actors are involved. Who's building the hardware, who's building the operating system, and who's building the apps. That was not the case with plain old telephones. Internet means it's a messy, complicated network structures. It's not, in the case of telephone networks, it was only one actor, the telephone network, allowing you to connect from point A to point B. In the case of the internet, it's much more complicated. You have to access the network, and that's your telephone provider, quote unquote. But then your data travels through the internet, going through intermediaries, and eventually reaching your endpoint, the app endpoint in which you're interested in that specific moment. So more actors are involved. So new actors besides telephone companies, users and governments, which used to be the troika of the traditional telephone networks. So let's say a few things about all these layers. Hardware manufacturers, operating system producers, app producers, and internet intermediaries and platforms. So these general purpose computers means that now the smartphones can potentially offer an unlimited number of services besides the traditional real-time voice and short text messages. So they're general purpose, like computers, so they can offer any kind of services that can be digitized. The telephone is not tied anymore to location but to a person, as we said. Same thing as the cellular network. So all this is the same as cellular network, but we used to have only the real-time tracking of locations, which made it very hard to be anonymous. But if we go and look at distribution of power, we'll see that the situation now has changed incredibly. The users cannot easily do anything anonymously, not only because the telephone is personal, but because of the sensors that we will see. There are multiple ways to track the person. So we can get information not only because the telephone is connected to a person through an ID when I buy the SIM, not only because the telephone company knows the location, but because the activities that I do using my telephone gives so much more information about me and what I'm doing, and I will get to that in a second. So the telephone companies know the usual stuff. They know where we are. So I just repeat what we saw before. The telecom companies can, in principle, monitor all the data traffic because my data traffic has to go through them before going wherever in the internet. So the telephone companies, in principle, see all data coming and going from my smartphone. Okay, in Europe, it was meant, in the US as well, they have to, because there is data retention laws saying that you have to monitor all the traffic and keep it in Europe, it's between 2 and 3 years, something like that. So to determine who did something requiring an internet connection is automatic, is coming from my smartphone, which has been strongly identified. To determine what was said, still requires, in principle, the wiretapping, so targeted old-fashioned surveillance, and the same thing about finding out what was transmitted would, in principle, require targeted old-fashioned surveillance. But in the last 10 years, I would say, 15 maybe, has become economically feasible to do something unprecedented in the history of communications, which is to record all calls and all data, simply because it's now economically feasible. To store all this information is doable, definitely by a state and possibly also by some large companies. So, and incidentally now, this also applies to traditional networks. So even the traditional phone calls can be all monitored and recorded. Okay? Now, the four levels, hardware manufacturers, operating system producers, app producers, and internet intermediaries. So, the hardware. Now, the really interesting part to regard thinking about power and smartphone is that this is becoming mostly a device full of sensors, which most users are unaware of. So this sensor can extract an enormous amount of real-time and increasingly intimate data about the user and environment in which the user is located. So not just location, but ambient light, the speed, there is a gyroscope inside, and in the case of a smartwatch, my heartbeat and several other personal information. So there are dozens of sensors and they increase over time. Most people, like myself, they have a small black tape over the camera because the camera is one of the sensors or the microphone, and it's apparently quite easy to switch it on without the user being aware. This is a very simple example, but let me say just a few words about ambient light sensor, okay? Ambient light sensor is right here, and it's essentially the one that it was introduced and explained to users saying, oh, it's only the sensor that switches the screen off when you make a call so we don't waste battery, right? So it's a very apparently innocuous sensor. But just a couple of weeks ago, a research paper came out saying what kind of information can be extracted from the ambient light sensor information. And essentially, and this information is accessible to most apps. When we install an app, the app accesses the information of many sensors, and often they ask access to the ambient light sensor, even though it's actually not connected to what the app does. Okay, but now the research shown that the app light sensor collected over time allows an app or whoever gets this information to know on which floor I live, how big is my apartment, what is the orientation of my apartment, and which connected to the location information can let companies know what the worth of my apartment, so essentially also my economic status, based on how big is the apartment, in which kind of building is it, in which part of town is it. And this information can be accessed in real time, for instance, by a store I'm entering, and they could in real time say, okay, this person is has an apartment worth €500,000 in a nice part of Paris. Okay, this is just an example of an apparently innocuous sensor like ambient light sensor. So in other words, the users have voluntarily, users including me, of course, I'm not any smarter, accept to wear a multidimensional tracker at all times about location, about ambient light, microphone, camera, and so on. Now that's quite remarkable. Now who decides the sensor information? Who decides which sensor goes in the phone? Is the hardware manufacturer. There are no standards. So the GSM phone was essentially, it has to be in a certain way, period. But smartphones being computers, the hardware manufacturers have much more leeway. They can introduce any sensor they think it's meaningful for their business model. And so the hardware manufacturers have a much greater role than in the past. And this sensor information is available at the very least to the operating system, because the operating system sees all the information on the computer, to the apps. We might discuss about privacy options, but let's assume that privacy, it doesn't exist, all the apps, and nobody knows exactly how this information is easily accessible to law enforcement. It's most likely that since this information ends up to apps, we might imagine third-party intermediaries building databases and selling this information to whoever, including law enforcement. So there is a much wider number of actors are tracking us, are tracking the users. Used to be only the typical, the old monopoly telephone company working with the government. Now it's a much wider number of actors. So who's building the smartphones? It's a small group. Most of the phones in the world are built by Apple and Samsung. Samsung has a much larger market share. Apple is, as usual, targeting rich white people, which is, I mean, it's not a joke. If you look at the statistics, the demographics is pretty much clear. And then we have Google, which bought Motorola years ago, doing something, but with a small market share. And now an increasing number of Chinese companies, Xiaomi, Huawei, etc. And it's interesting that even though I haven't seen anything on the market, Russia too said we have to build our smartphone. And I think it's starting to be clear why it's interesting, it's important to be in building the actual hardware. Or in the case of Apple, designing it and then having the Chinese build it, with probably spillover effects in the, for the Chinese know-how. Operating system, it's a duopoly. It's only Apple iOS and Google Android. Everybody else is just reduced to very small numbers. Both of them US companies. Apps, again, it's not like the laptop computers where anybody could essentially install whatever applications they wanted. Apple and then Google had this wonderful idea of app stores. So actually, there are intermediaries. The app doesn't reach the users directly. They have to go to the stores, unless you're very technically savvy. And in the case of Apple, there is a pretty clear vetting of apps. And there are a pretty large number of cases where apps have not been approved, not for technical reasons. So people have been talking about censorship, I think, with some ground. And then, of course, there are apps. Most people spend time to the app on the apps built by the big players. So even though we have an app store with thousands, millions of apps, most people spend a lot of time on the Facebook app, on the Google apps, on Apple apps, and then there are all the other apps. Finally, the intermediaries, in the sense that eventually our data leaves our telephone provider and reaches other intermediary ISPs, and we can go through the not using the app to the usual platforms. Okay, just to have a complete mapping of what happens. So, and I think I'm on time. Let's try to assess what has changed in the last 30 years. We used to have a highly regulated, usually a monopoly until the 80s, national industry. We're talking about being global and being national, international. So we used, the landscape was strongly national. You had a strongly regulated national industry, being the only entity knowing something about phone users. National governments worked with the industry for targeted surveillance wiretapping according to laws. Now, the smartphones arrive and they open up this pretty national setup. First of all, they have introduced an explosion of the amount of information collected in real time about users. So not only what we said, not only location, but a lot more information, and it's only increasing. The kind of information is determined by the phone manufacturer, which right now is concentrated in the US, South Korea, and China, and small actors elsewhere. The information available is now available to a much larger number of international actors, the OS producers, the app producers. Of course, now being general purpose computers means that also the security problems of regular computers now are security problems of this machine. So all the problem with virus and hackers, etc., that we had with regular computers, now they're moving to this. And the wealth of information that you can get from these devices is arguably larger than what you can get from a standard laptop computer. So if I have to sum up and think, what are the concentration of power? And I would say, well, of course, it's pretty complex picture as I try to sketch. But the phone manufacturers and the operating systems seems to me really the gatekeepers, gate control points. And so if we want to think about the system and the potential weaknesses, and we have to look at that. And in the last 15 years with the smartphones, we have seen a specific configuration of power due to technical industrial choices. So specific acquisitions, Google by Motorola, specific company decisions like Google from scratch creating a new operating system, Android. People almost now forget how important and large was Nokia at the time. Nokia had their own operating system, building smartphones, and it's interesting. A large European player essentially disappeared, having those two components, building phones and operating system. So this specific configuration has come about in the last 10, 15 years because of these kind of choices. Not so much, it used to be standards choices, it used to be GSM in Europe. GSM would create and shape the field, right? Now it's gone, because now we're in the computer area and in the internet area, so it's much more fluid, much more open for innovation in the positive sense, but also shaping whatever power strategy you want to shape. Of course, the question could be, this is the current situation right now, are there alternatives, are there possibilities for a different configurations of power? And of course, the answer is yes, of course, it's possible, okay? We, right now, because the way apps are made, because the operating system, the way the operating system is made, certain things happen to our data, and we have little control. The only control we have is when there are privacy options and we click on the privacy option, okay? Period. But for most users, it's incredibly opaque exactly what was going on here. And we have little way of controlling that when we click the privacy option. What happens is really in line with our preferences. We don't really know. We just click here and we hope that information is not going to the apps that we don't want them to have. Okay, so other configurations are possible, and maybe we can discuss that during the conversation. But let me just very briefly say, and this applies more generally to the computer field right now. I'm also thinking of the Internet of Things, for instance. We could, of course, have software that keeps the information much closer to the user and empowers the user to say, I want to share this information, or maybe the average of this information, not the raw data, that already would make a big difference, with the municipality. Suppose that I want to give my location information and the ambient light or whatever to the municipality of Paris because I want to help improve transportation in Paris. That would be a legitimate and good way of using my data, but it would be my choice, okay? Or an insurance company. That this is going to be extremely important. Insurance companies really, really want all this data, because of course they can come up with a profile of you which is extremely detailed and fine. Now, why does an insurance company have to have all this data, so intimate data in raw form? I maybe would be fine to say, okay, if I get a discount from my insurance policy, I can give you a monthly average of something, which is useful for you company, but is not that intimate for me. But this is not an option. It's not an option in any software whatsoever. So what I'm saying is that in software, typically at a level of apps or operating systems, we could definitely have different ways of dealing with data, and which means also with the distribution of power that I tried briefly to sketch. Thank you.
Thank you for the, if I may say, illuminating discussion, since you talked about ambient lighting. I would say I've done some surveys about people's interest in this topic, and what I have found, even concerning wearable detection, that if people felt they could get a discount, a financial benefit from the technology, they were very happy to give up all kinds of their privacy. And what I would put on the table for discussion is the question of people's choice of options in order to exploit these things. And even you mentioned the SMS and how that was an inadvertent creation. In other words, there are questions where protection of privacy is very important, and yet it can also limit people's individual choices about the use of the privacy, and it can also affect the rate of innovation for new technologies, such as ambient sensors. Thank you.
Thank you. In order to for individuals to make informed choices, the individuals should know the consequences. And what we're seeing now is that we have rushed a number of innovative and exciting technology. Please keep in mind I'm an engineer, so I'm sensitive to the beauty and the power of this technology. But they've been rushed quickly because there was a clear business short-term incentive to do that. But the consequences of having all this information available about a given individual are still largely unknown, meaning that week after week, researchers are studying this information and saying, oh, look what we can find merging this data with this data with this other data. Now, what I think is that I share your view that individuals should be able to make decisions about their data. Maybe not all the data, but I will come back to this. Let's assume the individual can make all the decision about all the data. Yet it should be aware of the consequences. And the consequences may very well be that in next year, or maybe now, the insurance company might say, no, we are not giving you an insurance, and we don't tell you why. But the real answer is that because based on information we got from your smartphone, you're too risky for us, or simply you're not a good customer for us. And in that case, the individual wouldn't have been in the condition of making an informed choice. Maybe if he had known that down the road, the insurance company would have either raised the premium or even denied coverage, maybe the individual would have said, no, I don't want ambient light sensor. I don't want this kind of information to be collected about me. So we have a problem. There is a lag between the introduction of the technology and the actual awareness of the consequences of that technology.
I could respond. Thank you. So just looking at insurance and ambient light, it could be that you could say, I don't wish to give the ambient light information to the insurance company, even though the insurance company might offer you a discount. And they could say, well, without that, we don't know what risk we're taking, so we won't offer you the insurance. And indeed, that's the proposition of many apps. If you don't agree with the terms of service, you don't get to use it. But let's just follow your example. So here, somebody to save battery life and to allow convenient navigation at night to turn from day, we have that. What is your actual program for the analysis of the ambient light? What, if you were king for a day, would you do about the ambient light detector in light of the knowledge that you have through the research paper about its potential downside? What steps should we take? Thank you.
Regarding the insurance company have been working for 150, maybe 200 years on aggregates, on large statistics, right? So they still do have that information. What they want to do now is to leverage individual information, and there is a strong asymmetric position because they know about me, both as a member of an aggregate and also with the apps now on individual, much more than I can grasp. So this asymmetry, I think at some point, actually is what we've been discussing. I don't even know that my information is being used to build a personalized profile on me, and we will have to deal with that. I don't know whether with consumer law or in some other ways. And regarding being king for a day, I think if I were king for a day, I would say that data by default should remain with the user, and then the user, following your lead, should individually decide what to do with that information. Right now, the default is the opposite. Unless you opt out, assuming you're offered the option of opting out, the information is sucked away. And so the change in the default is usually very powerful because it's most people follow the default.
Your talk made me think of two different things. First one is that Lev Manovich's thesis, very important media theorist, Lev Manovich's thesis about the fact that the only important thing is software and hardware is totally irrelevant is completely wrong. And hardware is as important as software when it comes to steering processes of communication and behavior in the digital age. That's the first thing I took from your talk. The second one, I have to think a little bit more about it, but I take it that our current focus on data, whether it is small or big data, might be a step not far enough. And you talked about parameters, multi-parameters, apparatuses. We are not just these. A mobile phone device is not just a collector of data. It's actually a bundle of sensors, and we have to move away maybe from this idea of static data that is being produced to something like a multi-parameter apparatus that actually can bring about new forms of surveillance and even of knowledge that not even the engineer that created it could be aware of. And when I take it, when I think about the violent reactions that in some European countries there had been against census, popular census, the fact that the state wants to know where you live, with whom you live, and for how long, and there were violent reactions in Europe, Germany especially. People just didn't want to give that information away. And today, people seem fine with saying, well, you know, if I get a discount at a supermarket, why shouldn't the supermarket know what kind of goods I buy? Who cares? I mean, there's nothing wrong about buying what I buy in the supermarket. But the point is, you don't know what you're giving away. And so my question would be, am I correct in assuming that what you're saying is that not only do the customers don't know what they are giving away, and only the people producing this technology do, but the next step would be not even the people creating these kind of hardware do know what this kind of technology is good for, and we have to move away from this kind of idea of surveillance of data and how much is given away and privacy and security to kind of different thinking that has to do with technology in terms of this multi-layered, multi-parameter dispositive.
Of course, what I'm saying is just guesses, because my guess is that we, in the case of the smartphones and sensors, we see two possible scenarios. One is there is a specific application in mind. If we had this specific sensor, then we could do the following practical, profitable things, and is perfectly rational. The second one is that I see a trend, which is a trend quite natural for technologists, but has become very much a trend also in governments, to say, produce and collect all the information you can, period. So all the possible sensors that make even slightly sense, cram them into this device, even though we don't know yet the uses for that. So this has been very clear. You find it also in many public statements. Since it's so cheap to store data, let's find ways of producing them, even if we don't know what's going to be used for. And the big data mentality is the mentality saying including also the thinking, let's amass data is good, intrinsically good. Whatever the provenance, whatever the meaning, let's amass it, because then we will allow computer scientists down the road to data mine it and extract value from it. And so if I had to make a prediction, I think that we are going to see more and more sensors included here. And again, just a guess, but the push towards smartphones, I wonder whether the actual idea behind it is that the push to smartwatches is that watches are pressed against skin, unlike the smartphone, which is close to us but not so closely intimate. And so I wonder whether the push to smartwatches was, we need a device that is usually acceptable for users that can collect information that we are currently not able to collect with a smartphone. but it's just a paranoid, educated case.
Okay, I have a question. It's whether there can be strategy for national governments to protect their own citizens against that, and which kind of strategy, if any?
Well, one obvious way of dealing with this kind of issues is privacy, and that's why we have seen and on the headlines of newspapers for years now, for instance, court decisions of the European Court of Justice dealing exactly with this topic of privacy. So let's say governments are mostly dealing with this or trying to deal with this kind of issues under the umbrella of privacy, which has become a major geopolitical point of conversation, for instance, between the US and the European Union. So when the European Court of Justice struck down the so-called safe harbor, that was created and approved in 2000, way before European governments even barely grasped any of these issues. When it was struck down, then there was a major crisis that was finally overcome with the new privacy shield agreement. So rather thinking about Europe, right now it's mostly the European level union going through the privacy negotiations with the US that these issues are addressed. Then if you ask me more, I could say, well, for instance, an industrial strategy. Again, it's really incredible that in the case of GSM, Europe with Ericsson and Nokia mostly, but also other companies, also in France, was a world player. And in the matter of 10 years, it essentially disappeared. And this, I mean, it's industrial strategy. And it should have been, I guess, much more in the awareness of governments because of this, at least part of this conversation.
Sure. Thinking on what you've said, I think the explosion of portable, smart, connected devices is really the most, I would say, formidable technological, I would not say advanced, but phenomenon of the past, like, 15 years. And the fact that you say that basically these are like multi-purpose computers, it's much more powerful in a sense that your smart connected toothpaste that gives, but it does exist now, you know, like your dentist and your insurance company, they know how frequently you brought your teeth and, how long and whether you use the right moves and so on. So these, I think, but in the case of smartphones, you are really the most powerful yet, maybe with the Apple Watch, but you have the most powerful, smart, portable, connected device ever. So I think it's very important because I think it's a sophisticated aspect of capitalism, like always trying to be as pervasive or even more pervasive as it was. You think now you're producing data for free and they are storing data on you on a permanent basis. But the fact that like users are now producers of data that has a value, but they do it for free, and that's, I think it's a very interesting phenomenon. And related to what Maurizio is working on documentality, the fact that they're recording systems. So it's not only about like producing a wide array of information about yourself, where you live, what is your, I try to deactivate all the time and I don't have any apps that are asking too much about, what I'm doing. And, they say, can I always be connected with this app? I say, no, otherwise, it claps at me and say, great, you've worked 12 minutes yesterday. And, you don't want that to happen because that's fine. It can be a useful piece of information for me. But if it's you communicate it to my physician or to my insurance company, then they can deduce or imply some kind of path, health path, and connected with many other information they can get. You can get a rebate or you can have a premium on your. And so that's my three reflections. And we invited here, even if it's contested scholar, or yet to be scholar, but contested intellectual, Evgeny Morozov has been working on that. We invited twice here and giving talks about, the dangers. And I think there are three, interesting levels. The first one is the economic model of that. Because when you have powerful players, I'm an economist, so I always tend to see the world with these kind of lenses, but they are anyway, given the importance of economy in today's societies, I think it's important, it's valid to look at that. And what type of economic model would be based on that? Because is it only a kind of sophistication of the capitalist economy, or are we moving into something else? You know, there are interesting discussions. We're talking about that with Nancy Fraser as well, because it's, I think, interesting way of looking at capitalism, but with extremely powerful devices. So it's the one thing. The second thing that relates to that, I think, the polity. I think it's a new version of the triad you mentioned: users, corporations, and governments, but in a totally different new setting. In a sense, and because here you have like this kind of privacy / security problem. It's not only about economic models, how you can sophisticate and maximize your profit, you know, squeezing out some value out of something that's been produced for free, which is, you know, one sophistication. You know, usually things that we produce are costly. Here we produce things for free. So, but here I think the privacy / security question is tremendous. I think it's of enormous importance for the polity, for the not only about the economic models, but the fabrics of societies. Because here in this country has been traumatized over the past like 18 months with terrorism. You have a primary of the right, and they are all saying, yeah, even the most liberal of the seven people contending for the right-wing primary said, well, we need to move the cursor between primacy and security towards more security. And she's like the more, I would say, brain-intensive person of the seven, you know? So this means that, you know, people are really prepared on the top of, you know, if I get a 10% discount on my premium, on my insurance, you know, for health or for driving or for whatever, then I'm happy to show that I'm a good driver, you know? I accept sensors on my, you know, in my car so that I can show that I'm recorded. Importance of recording and documenting my behavior, past behavior, and we know that all these models tend to project, especially if they are, you know, well connected with other sources of information. But here, I think it's important to have this polar privacy, security, and obviously Evgeny Morozov is on coming from Belarus, comes from the other side. You know, he knows what can be done with all types, or he can have some kind of intuition of what could be the governmental use or the corporation use of all these informations about smart cities where you have sensors everywhere, so you can, you know, predict where like manifestations can occur. They, like police in the States, they know now, they can locate people, they have like can track down smartphones of potential rioters after, a terrible like killing of an Afro-American person. They can figure out where people are, so they can send cars in various places in the cities so that people would not aggregate. So I think these are, I think, very important aspects of this privacy / security, asking, I think, key questions about the policy. So I think the question, and you mentioned that already, but I think we need to stress that and have some lawyers with us, is that it's a lot has to do with the legal framework. It's related to Emmanuel's and James' questions. It has to do a lot to do with the legal framework. What can be done and what cannot be done? And what type of information can be produced or what type of information cannot be produced? You know, to some extent, I think it comes down to that. And reversing the default aspect is one thing, but I think it has to be enforced by a kind of legal framework. And the only thing, even Google or Microsoft, the only thing that they have to be bound or to comply with are, to some point, legal frameworks. Like they will be fined $10 billion by the European Commission. But that matters for them, because this is an economic model. If you find $10 billion, then you know that there are some hard regulations. The fact that regulations are really behind now, and we are amassing and producing huge arrays of information about us, especially with the smartest connected portable device, and we don't know what the two other members of the triad, corporations and governments, are doing with that. And I think that's to be done, otherwise we'll be destroying the polity of the and the very fabrics of societies. So the legal framework, and I think we, in the years to come, I think we need to have like more, like people having kind of a legal take on that. And it has been done with like biology, with like, you know, frontier research in medicine and so on. They are always like involving a lot of lawyers. Those who are involving lawyers now are corporations. And it's really striking, and I conclude on that, it's very striking, like all the would-be terrorists or whatever in France today are connected on an app, Telegram, that helps us, allows them to communicate without having a kind of any track of who is doing what and what is the content of the message. And now I think these are key questions. Do we allow that? So it's very important for privacy, but then for security, say we need to crack these apps. You know, like what the FBI / Apple role on, okay, you don't want to give the information, so I hire 25 kind of Russian hackers and we'll find a way to do it. So I think the legal framework is key on that, is absolutely key, and I think we'll need in future discussion on that, because it's an ongoing questions for us at the college to have like more legal people involved, I think.
Just a very quick reaction. I totally agree the legal framework is important. I think it's going to be challenging to get the proper, at least proper according to my values, our values of democracy, legal framework, because governments are incredibly tempted to work with corporations right now, mostly for security reasons. Even though it's much more difficult, it has been shown, to use this information for security reasons than for commercial reasons. In the case, if I want to find out something about you because your shopping pattern, and I want to make you offer you a rebate, that's pretty straightforward. To understand whether a certain person is a potential terrorist is much trickier. Yet there is the temptation saying, let's look at this data, maybe we'll find the algorithm telling us, even though it's very elusive. Right now, governments all over the world are inclined to deal with these power actors that I have described. And the risk on the other side, from the social point of view, Belarus or not Belarus, is a sort of total social control, which has, you know, been a dystopia for a long time, but now is becoming much more technologically feasible. What I would hope is that we find a way, with the legal infrastructure, but not only the legal infrastructure, of creating a collective action of users using these tools in a different way. Because, as I said, it is possible to use them in a different way, but it requires a sort of collective action. And I don't really see now what are the powers that support these collective actions in a time where most of collective institutions are a shell of what they used to be that political parties, trade unions, etc. So I don't really know who's capable of supporting this collective action that we would need.
But we'd better find quickly.
Thank you. I have a reaction which is strictly related to what has been said by Olivier and also by Emmanuel. Usually we have a representation of the producers as people having a strategy. A project, a social project, maybe a dystopic social project, but a social project. We just seemingly they have no project. It's in a sense the technology who implements herself and grows up without any project. I always make the example of SMS, which is very clear. There was not a project of making so that the writing would prevail over the voice. Simply, something emerged this way. So there is not a big brother, which in a sense is worse, because you can detect the big brother, you can put in jail the big brothers, but you cannot put in jail a spread of emergence. The second point, so the big brother is not the issue. And I would say also, and the example you have given are very clear on this point, also the privacy is not the issue, because the private are not, the individuals usually are not or informed, either informed or interested. And we should not forget that half of the humanity voluntarily renounces to its privacy in the social network. So that, and all the legal action are concentrated to prevent perverse strategies and protect the individual privacy. Whereas the real problem is that the final result of this process will be the disappearing of the secret in social life in general, which means, for instance, the disappearing of economy. Because you cannot conceive, for instance, a stock exchange in a system without secret. If you are perfectly aware of the status of a company, then the system of stock exchange will no more work. And also the policy, the public the public policy, the relationship between states is not conceivable without a part of secret. And this is the first point. The second, so in a sense, the action on the individuals is could be less dramatic than the action on the social reality as such. And the second point is the fact that is this dramatic lack of strategy. When I say that a practical reason for the web is needed, also I also say that it's needed to give some goals to this kind of strategy. I believe that there is no one who is really responsible for this.
Okay, many, many different points. Let's see if I can address at least some of them. Let me go back quickly to Telegram, just giving you the, offering you the services of a computer engineer in the sense that also, WhatsApp now is end-to-end encrypted, but please do not underestimate the importance of metadata, in the sense that has been proved repeatedly that important decisions, even life or death decision, are made just on the metadata. Metadata means who's talking to whom, when, and where. Who cares about the content of conversation? And actually, in the case of Telegram or WhatsApp, etc., we know who's communicating with whom, and also because of what I said, where and when. Okay, and it's already a lot of information, and so the focus on also accessing the content of information, I suspect it's because they would like to have automatic natural language processing of the content, and that you cannot do with encryption, of course, but still you have a lot of information about metadata. Second point. Maurizio, I understand totally your point, Maurizio, but there is strategy. So I'm not saying there is a grand plan and there is a big brother, he knows everything. No, that's a bit funny. But it's also not true that it's only technology ruling itself. The landscape that I described to you is made of very clear industrial strategic decisions. And I also talked with people from the industry. And they were definitely aware of the strategy and where they wanted to get to. And you still see it every time. Now, for instance, I was talking with somebody from industry about the recent changes in iOS 10. And some strategic decision made by Apple with iOS 10 is shifting the power between Apple and the app producers for technical reasons. And so these are really carefully thought out decisions. And so the fact that now we have two operating systems from Apple and Google, which is 95% of the market, producers in certain country, not other countries, etc., is not happening by, it's not the technology deciding that. It's clear strategic decisions, which also means decision at the financial level, where are the phone manufacturers in South Korea finding the money to do that? And then you have to go into inside of South Korean economy, finding out where the money is, etc., etc. So it's a combination. And I think I mentioned it before. Sometimes they probably say, let's include a sensor, we don't know why. And then it's technology saying, whatever sensor is good, whatever data is good. But it is intertwined with a strategy. At least that's my way of looking at things. Regarding secrecy, you're right with your example of the stock exchange, but it's interesting because we ended up in a world where privacy does exist and there is extremely good privacy, but only for corporations. Because right now, if you look at the world, and also I was part of this world, you have the open government, open data movement, which means government have to be transparent because of democracy, etc., going back to 100 years of liberal thinking, fine. So governments should be transparent. Users, whether they like it or not, should be transparent, fine. Corporations, well, that's a trade secret. That's the obvious secrecy needed for a company operating, blah, blah, blah. And so this profound asymmetry is rarely remarked upon.
Thank you very much. All the questions have been terrific. I guess I want to ask a sort of synthesis of some of these questions about the dynamic role of information. It's interesting that you express a bit of skepticism about the legal solutions to privacy. I see your Berkman sticker on the front of your computer there. And it's true, we have the imperative for data release from government, but then they release the data, and the data is mined by private companies. And what was an enlightened effort to try to gain transparency is turned against in various ways. So I think it is systematic. But I also think that it's a grand experiment. And I'm very worried about privacy, too, and all the issues you raise. I mean, after Paul Snowden, who would not be worried in the United States? But let's talk about the future. This is pressing back to Jim's question. Everyone, how do we build accountability in? And algorithms are not inert objects in Plato's heaven. Algorithms are designed by human beings with a user application in mind. Often the user application is unpredicted in this case because we live in Turing's world, where ultimately the division between software and hardware is fluid. So it's important, the hardware and the industrial decisions, but the point of the universal machine is the fluidity. And the fluidity ultimately for the cultural search, this is Turing's word, a cultural search. So the point is, we have algorithms already that are being built by legal systems. For example, in the United States, sentencing is affected by bias, using algorithms to predict the likelihood that someone is going to commit a crime again. These are biased against African Americans. It's up to us to make the algorithms accountable, ultimately. It's up to us to make the laws accountable. So I don't want to sound as though I'm a namby-pamby naive person, but I think there are positive aspects to the grand experiment. People are willing to hand over their health data because in the future, medical companies can predict with great precision, for example, pancreatic cancer, which has a pretty narrow range of typical symptom clusters, they were able to predict on the basis of user data. So people are willing to hand these things over because of the positive knowledge aspect. The other point is a basic one of logic. If you have so much data, you have to mine it. It's useless if it's too big. So one has to have faith that somehow the accountability structures can utilize the software end and develop new treaty between governments, corporations, and individuals. But the knowledge point here is what I want to focus on. What role do the universities have? What role do our education systems have in developing knowledge on the part of individuals so that a discussion of accountability can go on? Because I think we don't even know really how to reason about this together in a dynamic situation where the value of a piece of information is unknown to you at the time you give it over, it is this dynamic parameter situation, and that's intrinsic, it's a logical point. It has nothing to do with people's opinions. So I wonder about the role of the universities, because the universities used to be the ones with the data, and the corporations used that. Now things have shifted, and presumably our institutions exist for reflection and the betterment of society. And again, there are many problems with the Enlightenment, but one of them is that we need to continue to critique. So it's our fault if we remain passive, too. So I'd like to hear more about that skepticism you have about the legal, because I share that view.
I think that a legal solution also based on human rights is definitely part of the solution. So we need that. And I agree with the director, and has been said that we have to work in that direction. One quick point, sensors are analog. So it's interesting, sensors are the boundary between the Turing machine and the world. And so it's interesting that the importance of sensors. The sensors are the windows on the world to the Turing machines. I totally, completely agree your synthesis. Of course, this data can be used for the good in many different ways. What I think we have to critique and then come up with with alternative proposals is different ways of using the data. Different ways in the sense that, of course, we all agree about personalized medicine and other wonderful applications, but the agents using this data shouldn't be just the corporations on the corporations' terms. It could be universities, it could be the state, it could be collective of citizens, can be a neighborhood. For instance, I would be perfectly fine to share raw data about my energy consumption or water consumption with my neighborhood, because we want to have a policy in our neighborhood to better use water or whatever our civic purpose. But right now, there is not the software, there's not even the human infrastructure in place. There are some limited examples, but it's really not there. So in this regard, you touched a point to which I'm very sensitive, the role of universities. Absolutely. Universities are currently extremely weak in this area because it's very fast moving. The data is not with us anymore, as you said. So that's a weakness. At the same time, universities can definitely do all the conversations like this among ourselves, but also involving the corporations, involving governments, involving journalists, in order to stress, on the one side, the risk, the need to have accountability, the ways of creating accountability, and also imagination, coming up with imaginative ideas of alternative ways of doing things. If I have to stick to one specific role of university, universities should educate the imagination, which by and large they're doing less and less. They're just accepting the world as it is, as if this is the best of possible worlds. And so educating the imagination in this specific realm, and then you have the computer scientists working together with the philosophers, and we could create, at least propose something new. Then it's an issue of resources. Who gives the resources to create this alternative view? But at least having the discussion and come up with proposals, definitely.